This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. A lot of us find it difficult to talk about women's sexual and reproductive health here in Malaysia, as we're still bound by many cultural and religious norms and taboos. In conjunction with International Women's Day, today we're speaking to two women who have spent much of their careers spearheading the issue of women's sexual and reproductive health right here in Malaysia. We have Dato' Dr. Narima Awin, Chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board, LPPKN, and she's here together with Dato' Dr. Raj Karim, the former Regional Director of the International Planned Parenthood Federation for the East and Southeast Asia and Oceania region, IPPF. And both of them wear many other hats as well and have worn many hats throughout their careers in public health. So we want to find out from them about the changes related to women's sexual and reproductive health, the changes that have happened in recent years, but also how and where we can make more significant progress for girls and women. Good afternoon, ladies. How are you today?
Okay.
All right.
Good afternoon to you too.
That's great. As I said, it's International Women's Day. Let's start on a more personal note first to get an idea of your long, illustrious careers in public health, in maternal and family health. Perhaps, Dr. Raj, we could start with you and you could talk a little bit about how long you've been working in this area, and especially the bulk of it was with the Ministry of Health and Ministry of Women.
Yeah, good afternoon to you, and thank you for having me here.
Absolutely.
Together with Dr. Narima. You know, we've been colleagues for a long time, so it's good for us to be together. I started my career way back in the 1970s, early 70s, doing maternal and child health, because at that time when I was posted to the Ministry of Health, we did not have a maternal and child health unit first. There was another officer before me, Dr. Bella Sinha, who was there, and I was there. But I had the post of MOUs because at that time, maternal and child health was like a non-entity. Mm. So both of us, Dr. Bella and I, were entrusted to develop the maternal and child health services. And we did that, you know, so it was like planning the content of the service, what should be the package of maternal and child health be, what should the structure of the organization be, because the health services at that time was not very well structured and not organized, right? We had health centers and midwife clinic camcorders, but they were not sufficient to serve the population.
Mm-hmm.
And our focus then was on the rural population. So we spent a lot of time looking at the content over the years until the end of 80s. So I was there like for a good two decades, mm-hmm. developing the services. And within that time, we had introduced family planning as part of maternal and child health.
Yep.
We had introduced nutrition. We had introduced school health. And of course, the whole of the immunization package, expanded program of immunization, EPI we had called it.
Yep.
And our focus at that time really was on survival,
mm.
you know, looking at women who die during pregnancy and delivery,
childbirth,
mm. yes, children who die because of preventable diseases, immunization, diarrhea, fevers and all that. So it was really like putting a basic package in,
mm.
a comprehensive package that would be accessible to all. And then we also built training, built resources with training of manpower, you know, nurses, public health nurses. Then came the jururawat desa, or community nurses that would serve the communities better to provide more service than what they were doing at that point of time, which was just midwifery.
Mm.
So after, at the end of the 1980s, I was posted to the Public Health Institute as the director for 2 years. So that time it was continuing the service, yes, but more on looking at the training and the facilities. So that's when we started management training for health, because the Management Training Institute was just ready at that point of time with the support of the World Bank. and UNFPA. I was there just for 2 years at Public Health Institute, and then I was sent to be Director General of National Population and Family Development Board for 7.5 years. Yeah. So I went in 1992 and I left in 2000.
Yeah. And what were some significant milestones during your time?
National Population and Family Development Board, I think that was the breakthrough of the whole of sexual and reproductive health. Because in 1994, we had the landmark Cairo Conference where 176 nations signed to population and development, you know, and within it, the importance of sexual and reproductive health and rights, because that was the conference that really worked out what is the terminology of reproductive and sexual health, what should the contents be, how should it be delivered, what is the focus of the target groups. And that was also the time that adolescent reproductive and sexual health was highlighted, because previously when I was in MOH, we did not really work on health of adolescents per se. Yes, we did the school health, the physical part, but didn't pay that much attention to their social well-being and their sexual well-being. So that was the time that we started to work on adolescent reproductive health and behaviour.
It would seem that even conceptually there would have been a gap. You look at children's issues, you look at women's issues from the maternal point of view, but you're not addressing a huge gap in between.
Exactly, exactly. So that in LPPKN, that was the time that we started to do it with the support of the Cairo Conference, of course, you know, and the Cairo Plan of Action. So after 2000, when I retired from government service and from National Population and Family Development Board, then I joined an international NGO, which is International Planned Parenthood Federation, as a regional director of East and Southeast Asia and Oceania region, 26 countries in our region. And that was really the time that we worked on sexual and reproductive health, but from a different angle, not from the mainstream, because all this while I was in the government, but this is from the NGO, you know, and to see how NGOs could move the whole issue of sexual and reproductive health and much faster than the government.
Yes.
Yeah, because the government is so bounded by policies and we have to be careful of the structural changes or cultural factors, religious, etc. But with NGOs, it was much better and faster. Yeah, so that was another unique and different experience for me in IPPF. And in between, I was with Sohakam for 8 years as well.
That's right.
Yeah. So in Sohakam, I worked mainly on looking at the reservations for the CRC, because at that time, you know, we had 13 reservations then government lifted 5 and then we were left with 8. So when I was with Sohakam, we had 8 reservations and then we managed to work towards removal of reservations. So now we still have 5. We only managed to work 3, but we managed to ask the government to accede to optional protocols 1 and 2 of the CRC, you know. So I look upon that as something that we had done that was had a beneficial effect or has a beneficial effect on children. And I also worked on the issue of trafficking. So that was the time that my eyes were open to violence, violence against women and children, how they were trafficking, exploited, etc.
And what about you, Dr. Narima? Your career also has very much been in public health, in the Ministry of Health. Would you want to tell us a little bit, as well as the kind of highlights, that the milestones that were achieved as well?
Okay, in terms of public health, unlike Dr. Raj, I spent a lot of years before I did maternal and child health. Because when I did my training and master's in public health, I majored in epidemiology and disease control. So I was practically the resident epidemiologist in the Ministry of Health from 1982. But because of the way career is being progressed in the ministry, or in all government departments, I suppose, so I got promoted from epidemiology and disease control. I started the non-communicable disease unit, for example.
Right.
Until one day, just like Dr. Raj, like I seem to follow her everywhere. When she was made director of the Institute of Public Health, there was another director after her, and I followed after that director. So I learned a lot of things in training, public health training, from what Dr. Raj left behind in the IKU, we call it, Institute of Public Health Research. Unlike Dr. Raj, from IKU, she was requested to join LPPKN. So she served LPPKN for a good 7-8 years. I was identified to further my career in the Ministry of Health, and therefore they made me the director of the Institute of Medical Research. So I was was the 25th director, and I was the first woman director of IMR.
Yes.
Then in the year 2000, they put me to what used to be MCH, which is now Family Health Development. So again, I followed in the footsteps of Dr. Raj. And it so happened that was the year that Dr. Raj retired from LPPKN. So I started my career in MCH. But and I think there were 4 or 5 directors between Dr. Raj and myself in the Family Health Development. But really, many of the things I continued what she and her colleagues have done, because Dr. Raj have done so much in that program. She mentioned to you early on, you know, the school health, nutrition was very much expanded under her. EPI, of course, we work with disease control. So before I was looking at EPI, by the way, is expanded program of immunization. So as an epidemiologist, I looked at the disease epidemiology, what vaccine should be introduced and those kind of things. But when I became director of MCH, I had to look at, okay, if you want to do this vaccine, how is it implemented? How is it reaching the children? So all that I took, I just continued whatever Dr. Raj has done, including family planning. And I repeat what she said early on. She was so much involved in looking at survival. Things were a little better. Of course, when we gained independence in 1957, our maternal mortality is like 1,000. 10 years later, it was 700, 600. And then suddenly, Malaysia became the darling of the world because no country, essentially no country in the world has done as well as Malaysia had done. How the maternal mortality came down so much. And a lot of it really, you know, it goes to really leaders like Dr. Raj, Dr. Sri Siti Hasma, many other people before. Rajanuddin, the late Rajanuddin, yeah, fantastic director general he was. So when I took over in the year 2000, maternal mortality has come down. It was like 39. It was like 2 digits instead of 3 digits. And in 1991, the previous director started something which I enhanced in the year 2000. We did the confidential inquiry into maternal death. That is a major milestone. Because, Shaoik, the auditing of a maternal death was started in England like from 1928. Nobody could take it up. England was doing so well. We were the first developing country to do what England had done. So that was done in the year 1991, I think it was. It was done very well. Then South Africa took. Now many countries are doing it. So that CEMD, so I as director, I work very closely with the chief obstetrician and the other specialties. So that's a major milestone. And we managed to bring down maternal mortality. It was very difficult to bring it down further because it was already low. Now I think we are about 24, 25. So, but we still have a lot of problems and the causes of death have changed. So that's one major milestone. I'll talk about milestones later on. So in the year 2000, so I was there for a long time. So the year 2007, I retired as Director of Family Health Development. If Dr. Raj went international through an international NGO, IPPF, I went another way. I joined the World Health Organization. So I was an international civil servant. So I was there for 7 years, 3 years in the Western Pacific region in Manila and 4 years in the Southeast Asia region in New Delhi. So I could continue with the work that was really my passion, maternal and child health. To go back a little bit further, after Dr. Raj has left behind his foundation for me when I took over in the year 2000, she also had started, but she did not elaborate early on because it was really in the infantile stage. She couldn't, I mean, she went somewhere else after that. So I continued with the women's health. So we had a big problem about cervical cancer screening. Pap smear was doing so badly. So I paid attention to women's health. especially cervical cancer and menopause management. Mm. And then I started healthcare of the elderly. Mm. But before I started healthcare of the elderly and made the health policy, I did the adolescent health policy. And as Dr. Raj said, LPPKN was already very much ahead of us. But we in Ministry of Health, we had the adolescent health policy. And I'm still now, when I became the chairman of LPPKN, it becomes an area of concern to me because I've done it before in the Ministry of Health. The other thing that I added on was children with special needs. Mm. So we trained all our nurses in all the clinics to do early detection of disabilities in children. So we detected dyslexia. I started autism screening and any other kind of disability. So going now, fast forward again to the year 2007, I joined the WHO. So I could do a lot of work. But the way the WHO is structured, child health is one person, regional advisor, and I was regional advisor for maternal reproductive health. So I didn't do child health very much when I was in WHO because it was really maternal and reproductive health. Mm. But going to your milestones, yeah, the confidential inquiry of maternal death was a major milestone. Two major milestones I did when I was in service actually was on child health. Before I retired in 2007, I did a lot of work on child health. So much so that last year, the Malaysian Pediatric Association honoured me with an honorary membership. Mm. The two things that I did with much difficulty, I must tell you, number one was expanding the EPI to introduce a new vaccine called Haemophilus Influenza B, HIB. Yep. Which was very expensive. Mm. And because I was introducing HIP, I also changed from measles, rubella into MMR. Mm. That costed millions. And it was during the Gawat time, no, 1999. Mm. I was still the desk officer then, I think. Oh, no, the 2000. You're right, I was there in the 2000. So that was one milestone. I expanded the immunization schedule. And one of the things that even I am amazed how I could do it. For the last 30 years, the pediatricians were fighting for treatment of children with thalassemia with desferoxamine. This is a very technical area, Shaoik, but let me just summarize it for you. If a child has thalassemia major, the child will die. Mm-hmm. To keep the child alive, you must give the child blood transfusion. Mm-hmm. If you give the child blood transfusion, after many transfusions, the child will get complications and die of side effects of iron overload. So you need a drug called desferoxamine to take out the iron from the body. Mm-hmm. It costs 700 ringgit a month to 1,000 ringgit a month. Mm-hmm. There were about 2,500 children dependent on blood transfusion. So to get that money wasn't easy for me, but I was lucky because Dato' Yang Berhormat Chua Soilek became minister. He's a medical doctor. He understood it. And very fast, I wrote the cabinet paper and I got it approved. So that's another major milestone, the vaccine, the thalassemia. And I told you about the confidential inquiry, adolescent health policy. Yeah, we did it a few years before that. And to follow on what Dr. Raj has done, because she went to Cairo in 1994. I did not. I mean, I was somewhere else. I was very young in 1994. So there is this program of action that Malaysia had. So all I needed to do was look at the platform, a program of action for Cairo. And 1995, you went to Beijing as well. Yes, yes. So there was the Beijing Women's World Conference. Mm-hmm. So I just enhanced whatever Dr. Raj has left behind from ICPD and Beijing. So that was good. The other thing that was a milestone then was, although gender was already highlighted, but very few countries took up the WHO module on how to integrate gender into health services. Mm-hmm. I was the first country in the Western Pacific region to do it. I did it three times. Mm-hmm. I used gender expert. We used the WHO expertise. And many other countries followed after me. I think China did it. I can't remember who else. But they learned from us. Mm. So those were the milestones that happened in my tenure. Yeah.
All right. You know, these are careers that have encompassed so much. You've seen so many changes. You've instituted so many policies. You've implemented so many programs and initiatives. And we will try to pick on one area. We can't cover everything. We'll try to look at sexual and reproductive health. And I think what you said about adolescents is particularly interesting, that looking at the adolescent girl and boy, but because ultimately the impact is on girls and women. So we'll go for a quick break now. In the studio with me, Dato' Dr. Narima Awin, chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board, or LPPKN, as well as Dato' Dr. Raj Karim, former regional director of IPPF for the East and Southeast Asia and Oceania region. We are talking in conjunction with International Women's Day today. We'll be right back after a quick break. BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. In the studio with me, Dato' Dr. Raj Karim, former regional director of the International Planned Parenthood Federation for the East and Southeast Asia and Oceania region. She was also the former director general of the National Population and Family Development Board, LPPKN. And joining her also, Dato' Dr. Narima Awin, who's currently the chairperson for LPPKN. And it's International Women's Day, so we're talking to both these ladies who have done a lot, you know, for Dato' Raj, starting since the 1970s to really further women's health and within the broader context of child and maternal health, as well as family health as an overall. I mean, you've seen so much, Dato' Raj. From the 70s, we were talking then about just basic survival issues, women dying during pregnancy and childbirth, and now things have changed significantly. We're dealing with very different kinds of issues now, presumably. What are the challenges that you're dealing with today now? And I mean, it would be glib to say, well, we've done a lot, you know, we can sit back and applaud ourselves. Or is that the case? Or are the challenges just still coming?
I think that if we can sit back and relax, Dato' Narima and I won't be here. We will be very happy, you know, taking care of our grandkids and having morning coffee. But unfortunately, it's not like that. Although the services are there and, you know, we are happy now that more than 95% of our people have access to basic health care. Our deliveries are in hospitals, no home deliveries and all that. I mean, on the surface, it looks good. And it is good because Malaysia has a remarkable health care delivery system and achievements, performance. Yeah. But unfortunately, life is not like that. If you don't work and you don't consolidate and you're not careful, it will come back. Maternal mortality will come back if you don't continuously work on ensuring safe antenatal care and safe deliveries and safe postnatal care. It will come back. And same with immunization. At one point of time, we were so happy, you know, that we have achieved 90% herd immunity, etc. But if you're not careful, see, polio came back. The last case of polio was when I was still in service, 1992. You know, was the last case of polio, and now it's so sad to see polio coming back. So I think we are not, or we should not sit down and heap on our laurels or whatever it is called. I want to go back to the issue of adolescents and young people that I said that we didn't quite work on while I was there. But I remember this so clearly that it was in 1985, 86, when we were already seeing teenage girls getting pregnant. And I remember we had two cases of abortion that were almost missed deaths, near deaths. And I brought this case up to my director and said, you know, we're having these young girls who are pregnant, who are not married, and they are going to end up with complications of pregnancy if we don't take care of them. So can I start a program for these girls? And he kept quiet. He didn't say anything, my director. So I got a consultant from Singapore. Nella Tan was her name. I got her from Singapore. She was from as a WHO consultant and Ministry of Education, Social Welfare and Ministry of Health. We went to Tanjung Bidara, Malacca, for 3 days, sponsored by WHO, and we sat to work on the problem. And we worked on a paper, you know, for the three ministries to sit together and work on the issue. But when we came back, sadly to say, none of our three agency directors wanted to take up the issue because they said that, number one, nobody's talking about it. Number two, you're going to highlight something and it's going to create public outcry or whatever. So we had to not work on it. Mm. Yeah, that was sad because the whole issue now was blown up again in the 1990s with the Cairo conference. And at that time, we were already seeing young girls getting pregnant. Mm. I remember when I just joined LPPKN, Dr. Narimah, 1993, the Director General of IPPF came, Hafdan Mahler. Hafdan Mahler was the DG of WHO. He left WHO and joined IPPF as a DG. And he came to visit us. At that time, I was at LPKN, and he came to see the minister. And he asked me a straight question. Do you think that you have girls who are pregnant here? I mean, unwed girls. And I looked at him squarely and I said, no, because we are a Muslim country. So we are protected. Religion protects us, I said, you know. And he says, no. He said, do a study. And that was the first adolescent sexual and reproductive health study that we did with funding from IPPF under the Vision 2020, it was called. Mm-hmm. That was the first research that we did under LPPKN. And that showed us horror stories. Mm. So the stories were, you know, that children were already in it. They had watched pornographic videos since they were 9 and 10. All those were already seen. You know, girls of 16 were pregnant. And so then what had happened was we wrote a cabinet paper at that time when we were in LPPKN, and we had some cabinet findings, or cabinet made some decisions, but unfortunately the cabinet decisions could never be carried out fully, you know, because of a lot of stigma and prejudice and hesitancy or reluctance on part of the agencies to do it. Yeah.
What would you have done? You know, let's say in an ideal situation, if you didn't have to deal with prejudices and all of that, what would you have done health-wise?
Yeah. At that time, what would I have done health-wise is to start an adolescent reproductive health program like Dr. Narimah did, but not only adolescent reproductive health, but in a wider sense, health program. You know, because you don't... reproductive health comes at a later stage, because I think you have to build up healthy adolescents from the point of view of physical health, nutrition, etc., and character building and values, because that carries a lot during the time of reproductive and sexual health, because behavior, attitude, responsibility are all important elements of reproductive health, or what we now want to do, to call it comprehensive sexuality education. Mm-hmm. I would have just started a program on comprehensive sexuality education in the wider sense, you know, so that we can provide information and we can provide correct facts, because the whole issue now is so full of myths and controversies and religious and social norms, mm-hmm. and a lot of it are myths, actually, or misunderstanding and personal perceptions.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would have worked on that, really. Yeah.
Dr. Narimah, you were able to put adolescent health on the table. What did you do, and what have we seen out of that?
Well, I suppose I did, because that was adolescent health overall. But the SRH was still difficult to do. Mm-hmm. And if you put another R, SRHR, sexual, reproductive health and rights, mm-hmm. yeah. it was even more difficult. Yeah. And I'd like to repeat what Dr. Rice said, the social, cultural, religious environment is such that even the cabinet could not implement what they wanted to do. But first, before I go on to SRHR, per se, I'd like to repeat what Dr. Rush reminded us just now, and younger people in the Ministry of Health should listen to these two old ladies now. Yes. Do not rest on your laurels. Mm-hmm. Success can come, success can be taken away.
That's right.
We are so proud of good access, and indeed we should be. Would you believe it, Dr. Rush? I don't know whether you have... I must give you the report. The World Bank did a study recently. They calculated backwards from the time we gained independence to the late 1970s, within that period of time, Malaysia built primary healthcare and rural clinics, your health center, two-tier system, three-tier system and all that. During those years, we averaged one clinic per 3.8 days. Yeah. Every fourth day, there was a new clinic.
Wow.
We built
We're doing better than China.
Yeah. In fact, just after we retired, we took a bank loan, a World Bank loan, which Tun Mahathir wasn't very happy, but we took a small loan and we really built more clinics. So Malaysia, I always tell those countries that I work in Manila and in New Delhi, what my country did, my first three prime ministers did was, they don't just say political will.
Yes,
they translated that political will to real money, real health service. And it was Dr. Raj's time also that we introduced this jururawat desa.
Mm.
That was a major thing with that. We just don't want to have a mere bidan anymore, a mere midwife. We want some more better qualified person.
Yeah.
So these changes were so good. So because of that, we don't have the second delay, okay? The first delay, it would be unforgivable if we still have it. The first delay is, why do people not seek care or delay in seeking care? They're not aware. They don't know. Oh, I didn't know I have to go to the clinic.
Mm.
I think it is a sin that we have committed if there are still women who are pregnant and said, I don't know, I need to go to the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
That shouldn't be there. The second delay is they know. They know they have to go to the clinic. They want to go. But they cannot go. Number one is social barrier. The husband said, I don't want you to take family planning. The mother-in-law said, I don't want you to stop giving birth. Number two is geographical delay, remote areas. But we have built clinics.
Mm-hmm.
But we had mobile services. The only people who we don't serve are perhaps the penans in Sarawak, and we give them helicopter service.
Mm-hmm.
And the third delay is financial, which I think, again, should not be a problem because we do have free services, free public
healthcare.
Then the third delay is where Malaysia has to pay attention. And I think I would laud the Ministry of Health for having done a lot on this. The third delay is the woman is aware. She doesn't have any constraints to come. She has money. She has whatever. She arrives at the health facility. She sees a rude doctor, an uncaring nurse, a waiting time of 2 hours, and the doctor sees her only for 4 minutes. This is the soft quality of care that we have to pay attention to. And I believe we are doing very well there. I have been interviewing people on the streets. They're very happy with what the Ministry of Health is doing.
Mm.
So not resting our laurels. Now, going back to what Dr. Raj was talking about, teenage pregnancy and how she realized she had to do something and it went to the cabinet. I'm surprised you actually told Hafdan Mahler that we are Muslim, so we do not have teenage unwed mothers becoming pregnant.
That was a story at that time, right? That was the pipeline we had to see.
Because when I was the regional advisor in New Delhi, I have 11 countries under me. Myanmar has 13% of maternal deaths due to unsafe abortion, which is the highest. Nobody has more than 10%. Myanmar has 13%.
Mm.
So I said, why not we consider safe abortion? Dr. Narima, we are good Buddhists. We don't do safe abortion. Okay, then I hope you don't get pregnant. That's what I told them. So you asked Dr. Raj a very difficult question. If you were able then, what would you have done? I think both Dr. Raj and I would not have stopped at anything unless, you know, like cabinet doesn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
I would have tried to convince people, okay, look at unwanted pregnancy in the public health approach. Do primary prevention first. Make sure these girls do not get pregnant. How do you do that? Comprehensive sexual education, which we have practically failed.
Yes.
Number two, give them oral contraceptives. Again, we have social barrier. You're not unmarried. You're not supposed to do family planning. So sex education, family planning will stop unwanted pregnancy from happening. If it does happen, then you give safe abortion, which we cannot do, Myanmar cannot do. Of course, tertiary prevention is giving post-abortion care. So that's a huge challenge that we are still facing, that we have certain norms, but I think we should not give up. There are many arguments. And when Pak Lah was the prime minister, my hopes were raised. He was handling this abandoned babies problem.
Yeah.
So he was deputy prime minister, by the way. He was chairing this big committee and he told
Hamid,
he was minister of religion,
Hamid Osman.
Said, Hamid, I want you to review the fatwa on abortion. I want rape victims, but anyway, rape victims to be given abortion. We had too much incest at that point in time. But to cut a long story short, politically, the religious leaders came in. It wasn't possible. So the fatwa was never changed. But I still do not think the doors are closed. I think now we have alim ulama who are more thinking alim ulama. Yes. I think Ministry of Health and LPPKN should not stop at this. Mm. So that is a very major barrier. I mean, we don't have time, but we have a lot of constraints and barriers.
Yeah. I mean, I want to talk a little bit about comprehensive sexuality education because there's one other major stakeholder in this, which is the Ministry of Education. What is the, from your experiences particularly, what is it like having that conversation? Why have we failed? You're right, Datuk Narima. We have failed. We've had the module for decades. Yeah, we can't bring it in.
Can I just start with that? Because, you know, we started with the Ministry of Education from the 1960s. And at that time, it was called Population Education. It was the first time we were really talking about it, you know, what should be sex education. You can't call it sex education. So it was called Population Education. And Ministry of Education was the first to work on it, actually, with Ministry of Health. Yeah. And then we went through phases of over 70s, 80s, 90s. And when the Cairo conference came up, the whole thing was revived. And I must say that we do have a curriculum now for sex education, although not called sex, it's called peers. Yeah, we do have a curriculum for sex education, but the problem is that it is not a separate subject. It is integrated into physical education or civics or biology or whatever it is. But the hard facts of sex education is still not taught. You know, because teachers are afraid, teachers are sensitive, teachers are not confident, teachers don't have the right training, etc. So very recently now, the whole issue is being revived and there have been two meetings so far to relook at the new, at the curriculum, the peers curriculum, and to align it. Do you know now we have this new guidelines, this international guidelines, international guidance on comprehensive sex education, which is done by ILO and which has all WHO and IPPF and UNFPA, UNICEF, all into it. So Ministry of Education, now this is work in progress now. They have taken this international guidance and looked at their own curriculum to accommodated to this new guidance because new guidance is a broader, is comprehensive sex education. It's broader. You know, it has values, it has character building, it has responsibility. It has what Dr. Narima said, the whole gender issue. You know, gender, power, feeling of confidence. And it also has a violence aspect. Dr. Narima mentioned incest, mentioned rape, because that's also related to comprehensive sexuality education. So now we're looking to see how this new module will come out, you know, with Ministry of Education and whether the teachers will be trained in this new module and how is it going to be delivered to the children. Because the way that it is delivered now is definitely not the way that it should be. Sex education cannot be taught in a classroom, you know, because you have to deal with children who have issues, who have problems, who want to speak. So there should be a service with it, whether it's counselling, whether it's to help them with any problems that they have physically, infection. Dr. Narima has been doing disease control. She will tell you the sexual transmitted infections that happen in teenagers. So we have to look at how it progresses. But now what is happening is that because the progress has been so slow, the progress has been so unsatisfactory, so now we are convening a big technical group. It's a technical working group, which I convene. I'm the convener, which has ministries, health, education, Ministry of Youth has just joined in. Religious department, we have all the NGOs, there's so many NGOs wanting to work and working on sex education, but not doing it the way that it should be done because everybody does little bits, you know. So we want to make sure that the same message is put across, that the facts are correct, the facts is updated, and whoever does it speaks in the same language. So that's what is happening now, right now.
I mean, it's so...
Consultant Arima said we are not stopping.
No.
In whatever position we are.
It's so enlightening to listen to you, Dr. Raj, because I gave directive to my staff. Can you organize a meeting with Ministry of Education? We have to relook into this. But I'll touch on that later on. So I would start by telling you two very interesting anecdotes. I was in the Ministry of Health, but Datuk Siti Zahra Sulaiman was the minister in that national unity, but she wanted me to chair the task force on how to do sexuality education in school, mainly that time, not so much out of school. And I had a series of meetings. The interesting anecdote is this. The Ustaz from JAKIM told me, Dr. Narima, this I have to tell you in Malay. Jangan lupa ya, buat curriculum tu nanti, tolonglah sebut, bukan sahaja berzina itu dosa, apa jua yang mendekati zina juga berdosa. It so happened that was just 2 weeks or 3 weeks after that couple was caught in KLCC Park for holding hands. A young Malay boy, young Malay girl, they were charged and caught because they were holding hands. I said, terima kasih banyaklah Ustaz. I like your comment very much. But in the next meeting, can you come with something? I'm giving you homework. Can you come with a list of me, apa dia benda-benda yang mendekati zina? Because I'm only chairman of this committee, the one who's going to teach other teachers, will the teachers know apa dia perkara yang mendekati zina? I'll give you an example. I'm not wearing the tudung. Does that lead to zina? The couple who held hands at the park 2 weeks ago, they were holding hands. Is that a preamble to zina? So the teachers need to know. Do you need to wear gloves? You know what he said, Datuk Raj? Dr. Narimah, you ni pandai sangat lah. I cannot do the homework. Let's forget it. So he gave up his own suggestion. That was one interesting anecdote. I was so successful. I was a consultant to WHO to do sex education in the Pacific Islands. The church is so powerful. In Tonga, in Samoa, in Cook Island, church leaders are so powerful. I had a meeting in Fiji. I was warned. The church leaders are going to fight you. And true enough, one of the church leaders said, Dr. Narimah, it is against the will of God to teach sex. By the way, I'm not teaching sex. I'm going to tell them why they must not have sex until they're ready. So I won him over a little bit, but it wasn't easy. But it was good. Kiribati was the first country that gave contraceptives to unmarried girls. I was very proud of them. Many years later, when I was working in WHO, somebody came to my office in New Delhi and said, Narima, there was a meeting in Geneva last week. And they were talking about CSE, Comprehensive Sexual Education, and the representative from the Pacific Island, I don't know which island, stood up and said, it is against the will of God not to teach sex education. Dr. Raj, I cried. Yeah. I shed tears. Yeah. My God, I changed them 180 degrees. That's it was against the will of God to teach. Now it is against... So that was interesting. I need to... So going back to what Dr. Raj said, so now... In school is a problem. Curriculum is there. I'm glad you're looking into this. What I told my staff to have a meeting with the school, bagian sekolah or wherever, whoever, is we make the statement, teachers are not teaching sex education. Exactly. And you have mentioned the reasons why. But there has been no empirical data, no proper study to say what really are the factors.
That's true.
Could it be time? There's too much in the timetable. Could it be the personal value? I don't agree with this, so I don't want to teach other children with this. Could it be because the module is not good enough, which I think your committee must be looking into? Could it be the module is a module, but you may need tools? Because I saw a lot of tools when I went to Sweden to see how sex education is done. So this statement, sex education in school is not optimal, teachers are not teaching, but we don't really have the real evidence on why it is happening, how many percent is being taught. So I think there is something that really need to... I hope the new Minister of Education will make a difference.
I hope so too. We're all waiting
then
for that.
Out of school. So we have to depend on out of school as well. That's where LPPKN comes in. So I have my cafe at Tin, and we do sex education for children out of school. And the attendance is good. I think... there's a lot of peer education and peer counselling there. As Dr. Raj said, it's not just giving them information. It's giving them counselling. It's giving them skills. It's giving them confidence. It's answering their difficult questions. You know, it's like people don't even want to talk about masturbation. And when I went to student, there was a subject just on masturbation. So these are things that we really have to do for sex education.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked a lot about policies. I think, and we're running out of time, so I just want to quickly, I think at the end of the day, we're talking about girls, young girls, empowering them. Yes. Not only making sure that the services are there, but how do we make sure that they feel that they have the right to access those services and that they can go to someone to speak up about it. Let's talk about what, you know, if I could get each of you to share with me, girls in Malaysia facing now that could potentially be hindering their access to, not only sexual and reproductive health services, but the rights, their rights. And what do we need to address there? Where if we're looking at an individual girl.
Like I said earlier on, what Cairo did was not just SRH, it was SRHR. So the rights is there. And we go back to 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 has, I think it's Article 25. It really mentions about children and women having rights to health. So we are a signatory to that. So we must go back to all the rights documents. Dr. Raj mentioned CRC, and I'm so happy that from 13 to 8 to 5. We still have 5 reservations.
Yes, and the most difficult ones.
So we are a signatory to the Convention of the Rights of the Child. So you must, the government must understand if you are a signatory, you have to honour. Mm-hmm. And of course, we are signatory to CEDAW as well, the Convention on the Elimination
Discrimination
of Forms
against
of Discrimination
women.
Against Women. So I think we have enough rights instrument, but I think the barrier is still, they are not aware, like I think you suggested that. So these girls maybe are not aware. So back to that CSE in the school tadi. So when you teach them comprehensive sexuality education, the rights thing must come in. And Suhakam has done a lot of work on that one. So that must be. And LPPKN, I'm using another platform for that when I do my parenting skill. I will tell the ibu bapa, I will tell the parents that it is your child's right to know. You must give them the information. If you cannot give them, they must be given the information somehow. And I'm glad that the Ministry of Women and Community Family Development is going to relook at the legal provisions, particularly on the role of the internet, what I call the good, the bad, and the ugly. Look at pornography on the internet. Look at social grooming and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think there are many policies that we have done. But like you said, there'll always be something more that we need. That we need to do, you know. Mm. So right now, I think we have done quite a bit.
Yeah. Dr. Raj?
Yeah. For me, I think that I agree with Dr. Narima. You know, we talk about the issue of rights, and it's so difficult to implement the rights of young people. Yeah, you can have the right to education, you have the right to health, which is already happening, mm-hmm. is good. But the right to their own bodies, I mean, you know, the right to knowledge about what's going on about themselves. And, well, we did introduce, you know, about menarche, periods, etc. But we still, it's not central. We're still depending on other people to do it, whether it's NGOs or the corporate companies, etc. So it should be a rights-based issue, that it should be a normal part of education, that you teach children about their own bodies and the right, you know, for them to take care of themselves, the right to correct information. Mm-hmm. So by not teaching them comprehensive sex education, we're actually denying them the right to have the best knowledge and the That's full right. knowledge, and the right also to take responsible decisions. Because there are many girls who just say that, oh, you know, I didn't realize that just with one fling or one night I have, I will end up in pregnancy. They don't even know that they're pregnant. Mm-hmm. You know, and some of them have delivered their babies without even knowing that it's a delivery and not a stomach ache or pain. Yeah. So we're having children like that, and it's so sad that they don't know what's happening to themselves and their bodies. So I think it's time now that we put aside all these, negative thinking or negative perception, and just teach children so that they'll be responsible and they know what to do for themselves. Yeah. And they also know how to prevent violence, because so much is happening in homes and in families. Intrafamilial violence is very high, you know, whether it's sexual violence and also by people that they know. Yeah. And of course, Dr. Narima hit on a real bullet today by saying online violence and online sexual exploitation is becoming a very big issue, and children should know about it. Almost all kids now use a handphone, but they don't even know the safety of using the handphone.
Mm.
You know, we do a lot of training from the NGO on sexual grooming and safe online usage of online safety. And about last month when we did a training, we had an 11-year-old boy who told my trainers are very qualified people, and they're Americans from US, and he told the trainer, "You're wasting my time," he said, you know. And then we looked and asked, and he says, "I already know how to go into the dark web. Why are you teaching me all this?"
Oh,
you know. And the trainer asked him, then later on, not in front of the whole audience because we had children, then the trainer called him aside, and he knew exactly how to go into the dark web. He knew exactly what he's found there, you know. So I think we have to be really careful and give children the education
because
and the information
right now,
that they need.
We're just playing catch up with what they're exposed to.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, and just on a final note also, it's so important to have boys in this conversation, in this education, because you know, girls are not existing in this world alone. Mm. They're not going through these challenges alone. It's because of their interactions with definitely with the other with the opposite sex.
Would you allow me to respond 1 minute to that part?
So when you left Dr. Raj, so the adolescent health and sex education in LPPKN has started off, and then later on it became what they call PAKERTI, Comprehensive Sexual Education. It's a policy, national policy. There's a strategic plan.
Yeah.
Yesterday I started the plan of action. Not for PAKERTI overall, but they collected evidence that boys have a lot more problems than girls. Yes, they started earlier. They have doubled the number of sexual partners and all that. Yes. So I'm starting a new module called SRH for boys.
Mm.
So there's a lot to be done. And in that context, I wanted it to be to have a meeting with the Ministry of Education.
There's a global study on this that's going on by ACPACT. They're doing a global survey on exactly this issue on boys. So it'll be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And telling them responsibility when they grow up as men.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. If we're talking about violence, especially, you know, we can't forget, we can't leave them out.
Yeah.
And then only bring them in when they are as much a victim in a way. We've run out of time. This was a great conversation.
Another hour,
That's right. With Dr. Raj Karim, former regional director of IPPF for the East and Southeast Asia and Oceania region, as well as Dr. Narima Awin, chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board, LPPKN, in conjunction with International Women's Day. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.